Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got three interviews up today. First, in a couple of minutes, a brief one with Sean Keenan, who runs a small independent record label out of Madrid, Spain, called Blanco Music. And he had a tremendous little rant I came across on the web the other day about what the internet is doing to music and for people who are trying to earn a living as musicians. And then about 15 minutes from now, we'll speak with Rita Shera, the analyst of public opinion and demographics, about how the changing nature of the U.S. electorate means that the Republican Party and its conservatism will be a shrinking force in U.S. politics, and the Democrats will be an increasing force. And we'll ask him, well, what that means beyond demographics, if there's any politics to it as well. And then just after the half-hour mark, we'll speak with Bill Hartung, who is with the New America Foundation, a longtime analyst of the arms trade and military spending, about what the Obama administration is up to in its military strategy and how much we're spending on war. Hint, it's a lot. No time for any comments on the economic news today because the last-minute edition of this Sean Keenan interview. I want to say before I set this up, I am not doing apologetics for the record industry. I'm just offering this as something to think about how in this world where people expect everything for free, we can pay for musicians to live and journalists to live and reporting to get done and the arts to get financed. In this world where people expect to download everything for free. Prince said the other day that the internet is dead, which prompted chortles among the web savvy. Sean Keenan has some interesting comments on that. You can check out the blog of his label, blancomusic.com, blancomusic.com, and read his spirited comments in full. Or listen to this, Sean Keenan. Prince said that the internet is dead the other day, which prompted chortles all around. You think he actually has a point? Tell us about that.
I think the point was actually to get people to have those little chortles and to react in a neat way to feel slightly affronted by the idea that the internet is over and dead. And one of the first things that people did was to pass the quote around on the internet in the sense of, oh my gosh, we all need to stop now, ha-ha, the internet's dead. Silly Prince, but in fact what it did was make an awful lot more people talk about Prince than if he had, for example, gone and said, I think the internet is no longer a valid way for people to promote and distribute their music.
Yeah, okay, so what is the problem with the internet? There's a line circulating among enthusiasts that this allows unknown bands and artists to achieve a level of exposure that they would not before the days of the internet. What's your problem with this arrangement?
My problem with this arrangement is not, of course, that the paradigm is not correct. There are bands now who can be heard in different various areas of the world that they could never have been heard before if they'd had to be restricted to the physical medium. The problem I find with it is that it's making it too difficult for artists to actually make a living, because what's happening is that although they can develop their profile wonderfully highly, that the actual buying or sales of their products are not actually being reflected by the amount of publicity they're generating. At the moment, it takes so much more publicity to actually shift the same amount of units or actually, you know, make the same amount of money from your music. It takes 8 or 9 times as much promotion to do that, because 8 or 9 times as much as your product is going into areas that you can't monetize, like file sharing, piracy, or musical streaming sites, which do not give artists a good deal.
If we go back several years, actually more like 10, when the new economy was all the rage, there's a lot of talk about how you could give stuff away on the internet, which would only increase your visibility, and then you could then make even more money because you had, this would make people more aware of you than ever. And then you would be able to monetize your publicity that way. Is that kind of publicity not really turning into the sales that were projected back in that heady era?
It can be for some. For us, I think it just verges into the area where you're exploiting your fan base, really exploiting your fan base, because what it's doing is asking your fans to consider the music itself to be worthless, and just as a way of driving your fans towards overpriced box sets or merchandise, which really musicians are not supposed to be in the business of selling T-shirts or box sets. Musicians are supposed to be in the business of making music, and they do that very well. The problem for the moment is that musicians are being asked to diversify into areas that they're not necessarily very good at. I don't really want my favorite artist to be good at spreadsheets, or if they are, that's wonderful, but I don't want the only artists who I'm able to buy music by to be the ones who are very good at spreadsheets, and that's turning into be the filter now of what music makes it or not, what music becomes successful is how good the musician is at actually building that sort of secondary, and it really should be secondary industry behind what is important, which is the music. That's the only thing that's still going to be there in 50 years' time, is the music. Music's eternal. Music's priceless.
Well, if we go back to the old days, a lot of people would say that the average artist, unless you really hit the big time, the average artist didn't make too much money or none at all from say, record contracts. That the evil record industry got all the money, and the artists saw none of it. Is that true, and how's it compared to what prevails today?
There are certainly some horror stories out there, obviously. The big one, of course, is mainly based around the idea of the record company keeping the publishing of the songs, which is basically the performance rights and the additional benefits that come from releasing a song. And in fact, usually the sales of music itself are only a part of the revenue that can be made from the publishing rights on a piece of music. For example, if you use that piece of music in an advertisement, there's a fee for which you would be paid. That's one of the old record industry scams. The thing about the record industry, the old style big label industry, is that it's coming in for a lot of criticism at the moment. But the criticism is mainly designed, or at least has been jumped upon by people as a good way to justify their actions, which are normally the actions being justified is not actually paying for music. The thing that large major labels did and generally did and still do is advance some money on the unsigned band, or at this point the still unsigned band, to give them some money in front, for which they certainly collateralized that initial investment and made a lot more money out of that initial investment than they initially invested. That's part of the deal. That's why the money I borrowed from the bank to buy my house is going to end up costing me more to pay back than the money I actually received. There's always going to be a risk involved, and you know, banks are not willing to put their money into the career of an artist or a career of a musician, whereas record labels are. I didn't necessarily want the piece to be a complete vindication of the record of the major labels. It does seem to have been picked up upon as that, but they took a risk, you know. They always took a risk, and they charged for that risk. But they put some effort into and some risk into and some belief into the artist and put some money into the artist, which iTunes don't do. The new internet music economy does not do. You know, if Prince takes his music to iTunes and asks for an advance, they'll say no. But why shouldn't he? If he's going to bring them more traffic, if he's going to bring them more business, why should he not at least be allowed to ask for that service to be paid for?
Now, Prince is an established artist, big name. Maybe his best days are behind him, but still a very big name with a very substantial artistic as well as commercial reputation. How does someone like him fare in today's musical landscape?
Well, he's very difficult to categorize in terms of how a large artist does in terms of the internet market, simply because he will not allow his music to be hosted on an internet provider. He's very savvy in this way. In fact, he's creating an almost new underground market for his material because he's not allowing it to be everywhere and ubiquitous. he does have that name, that when a new Prince Records comes out, there will be fans who want to hear it. And rather than actually go to Spotify or Mob.com or any number of areas on the internet where you can hear something for free and assuage your need to hear that song for nothing, he's actually saying, no, I'm going to make my product exclusive, non-available. If you want it, the way that you will get it will be by coming and buying it. And I'm really very, very envious of him to be in this position where he can do that. We certainly at Blanco Music are not in that position yet, so we are in the position where we have to do what is expected of us by the market leaders.
How does the iTunes model work for the artist? What the artist get out of the iTunes conduit?
What the artist gets out of the iTunes conduit is distribution. Distribution throughout the world, throughout their site, and they are the market leaders in digital music. They have a 70% share the last time I looked, and they are the go-to site for music. And what they do offer a musician is ease of access from the fan base. The fan base can go there, can access your music, and can download that legally and buy it. What they do ask for in return for that is a 30%, well, around about 30%. It depends on how many records you sell. I think it's a sliding scale. They do ask for a percentage cut of that. Some would say that that's a perfectly reasonable deal, and you know, in some ways, it is a perfectly reasonable deal if you do shift material for people, or at least if you give them a conduit where your material can be bought, you should be able to charge a percentage for that. I'm not too worried about that. The only thing that I have an issue with is that the markup, that the commission that they assume is their right to take, is based upon an old music paradigm, an old style music industry concept that, you know, the bricks and mortar shop had to buy in, had to get in product, had to pay for rental and pay for storage and pay for the records that didn't get sold and hope that some certain ones did. And for that risk, they justify it. They asked for a markup, for a decent markup, for a decent percentage. I don't see how iTunes can justify similar markup, similar compensation for more or less having your piece of music on their server, which I don't believe can cost them a great deal.
And then, of course, as you point out, the artist doesn't get an advance out of this arrangement.
There's no advance. There's no advance from iTunes server, no.
And then how is the money divided between the record label and the artist? Is it pretty much on the old model?
That will depend from label to label and artist to artist. These things are always worked out between the labels and the artists. In our label at blancomusic.com, we split everything 50-50. And that includes all the expenses that it takes to record the music, to distribute it, to manufacture CDs, to do all the various administration that comes along with those things. We just think we do something along the same lines as someone who we consider something of a mentor, David Geffen, who chose never to have any contracts with any of his artists. He just worked on the lines of, if you're not happy with this, you can go at any time, and that's the way we work with our artists too. You know, if they feel that they can get a better deal somewhere else, well, they're welcome to go. We only want to work with people who want to work with us, and we're quite upfront about what it's all going to cost and who's going to get what between whatever revenues do come in.
Now, I'm coming at this mainly from the world of journalism, where it's really no one really can figure out how journalism is going to get financed in this new era, and how reporters and writers are going to get compensated in this new era where everyone expects everything for free. Do you have any idea of how musical artists can get compensated in this new era that allows them to earn a decent living from their art?
I don't think it's all over just yet. I do think that there is the possibility to, with a little bit more profile and a little bit more people talking about this, there is the possibility to convince people that they are under a moral obligation to fund or to compensate the artists for the work that they get, for the product that they receive and that they enjoy at home. I mean, I wouldn't like to see music end up taking the status of a charity where you're really just expecting people to give you compensation because some little voice in their conscience says to do so. But that's not necessarily always something that you can not expect either. People now are very much concerned with the ethics behind the coffee that they buy. They're not happy to buy eggs which are not free range, for example. There is a conscience that people are essentially good. I do believe that people are essentially good, and if they can be made aware that what they are doing or what they're expecting is devaluing music or print journalism or whichever medium you work in that can be reduced into digital pieces of data, which say, you know, binary data, which can be moved from place to place. It's not a case of how do you stop people doing that. People will do it if they want to do it. The question is, stop them wanting to do it.
And that's the voice of Sean Keenan, who runs a small independent record label, Blanco Music, out of Madrid, Spain. You can check out their stuff at blancomusic.com. And as I said, I'm not necessarily doing apologetics for the record industry, but I do want us to think about how artists and musicians and writers and journalists and stuff are going to get paid in this internet era. And it's not really clear. And so I think I'll be returning to this topic in the coming weeks and months. But now let's hear a little bit of one of his artists. This is... available on the blancomusic.com site. This is Stay by Ella May.
Anything I take for granted, I put them all away. All the things that you have given me will never fade.
And that was some of Stay by Ella May, one of the artists in Blanco Music. You can get it that and other tracks at blancomusic.com. And we're now joined by Rita Shera with a very different set of topics here to address: demographic change and the future of the parties, a paper he wrote, which is available from the Center for American Progress website. Welcome, Rita. So, you say two or three elections down the road, the United States will no longer be a white Christian country. Give us the details.
Yeah, that's correct, based on trends that have been pretty steady for a while. By the election of 2016, and at the latest by the election of 2020, we'll be no longer be a majority white Christian nation, a combination of those trends.
Okay, so let's talk first about the white part. What's happening to the demographics of the U.S. population?
Well, as is pretty well known, every year we have a slightly larger minority share of the population. Every year a slightly smaller non-Hispanic white share of the population. And the trend has been going on for decades. It's projected to continue into the next several decades. And the latest, the most definitive census estimates, they may fiddle around with the year and as they go forward and do more projections. But right now it's pegged to be about 2042. When the United States will become a majority-minority nation. By the time we hit 2050, it'll be 54% minority and 46% non-Hispanic white. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that sounds like a lot different country than we even have now, and certainly than we had in the past.
And then what about the Christian part? You know, we're always told this is a Christian country. The evangelicals are very prominent in our political discourse. But are they a fading force?
Well, the white evangelical, high attending part of the population is not so much declining as only remaining stable, basically. But one thing people don't understand is that the fastest growing religious group in the United States are people who don't have a religion, who are unaffiliated, who you might call secular humanists. They've been growing like topsy, for the last several decades. And again, we look at projections and we see by the year 2025, anywhere between a fifth and a quarter, 20 to 25% of adults will be, unaffiliated, have no religion at all. And that's a very fast rate of growth.
A few years ago, I saw a Gallup poll showing that fewer Americans would vote for an atheist than they would for a gay person for president. Is that going to change?
I think that will change, though. I think you could argue it is the final frontier, even more so than voting for someone that's gay. Politicians, whether or not they're particularly religious, still feel obliged to proclaim their religiosity and their faith in God and all that. Now, logically, that should change over time and become less of a stigma as we have more people who are secular, just flat-out secular themselves. Plus, if you look at people from the younger generation, the millennial generation, they're just generally more tolerant about stuff like this. Their spirit, their religiosity, such as it is, tends to be heavily inflected with a more diffuse spirituality, and I think they're just going to wind up being more tolerant on that front. But I think we got to go on that one.
The demographic changes we've talked about, the increasing minority share of the U.S. population and the increasing secular share of the population, this should be good news for Democrats over the coming years, right?
Well, it's definitely good news. I mean, when groups that are basically pretty sympathetic to your perspective and pretty hostile to that of your opponents increase their share in the population, a standard mix effect says that this benefits you as the changes go on. Now, one thing that could stop that is if the level of support Democrats get from some of these groups declines over time, which would be a countervailing force against the increase in share. But we're not really seeing that at the present time. So, we'll see how things go in the future. But so far, I mean, especially given the Republican Party as we know it today, as they have been acting before Obama got elected and certainly since after he got elected, they're not hugely attractive to these growing constituencies.
Now, if the Republicans can stop, when they pause in their railing against immigrants, they sometimes suggest that they could woo some of the Latino population by appealing to social conservatism. What do you think of that? Is that rich soil?
No, it's not rich soil. This is a particularly popular piece of political conventional wisdom that's pushed by people on the right, and there's actually very little empirical foundation for it. First of all, Hispanics aren't particularly socially conservative as compared to whites. For example, they're no more supportive of gay marriage than whites. If you look at their overall social positions, in fact, there are some indexes, sort of overall summary assessments of social conservatism that have Hispanics in general being more liberal than whites, not less liberal than whites. And it's not just because of immigration. It's looking across factors. Finally, Hispanics don't vote on the basis of social issues. They just don't. I mean, there's very little evidence that that's how Hispanics cast their vote. They tend to be much more influenced by economic issues, by issues around education and health care and so on. This is what they really care about, or attitudes toward Latinos, for example. That's what they want to cast their vote on. They don't want to cast their vote on the basis of abortion or gay marriage. So this is a chimera. This is something that has bedazzled Republicans for years, but it's just not going to work out that way.
And what about the possibility that as the Hispanics get more assimilated to the U.S. population, they'll start voting like white folks?
Well, again, we don't see a lot of evidence of that. You can look at data from large surveys of Hispanics and look at the differences between immigrants and those who are native-born and those who are second generation and third generation and so on, and you don't see that much differentiation. If I'm remembering from the report, I think that the Democratic Party ID advantage among native-born Hispanics is like 32 points. So, yes, there will be more native-born Hispanics as a proportion of Hispanics as a century goes on, according to projections, but when you've got that kind of party identification advantage, even among people who are born here or not immigrants, who have stronger roots, then that suggests this is something that's not going to be that easy to move.
Now, what about the white working class? Tom Frank, of course, got a lot of attention for what's the matter with Kansas, the white working class allegedly voting against its own interests. First of all, what do you think of that argument? And second of all, what about their weight within the electorate?
Okay, well, the issue of whether they're voting against their interests, I think, is a complicated one and maybe a little bit deceptive way of putting it. I mean, what are people's interests? Interests are, people define their interests as they see them, as they feel them. It includes things that go beyond their class position, go beyond, those sort of very tangible material things, includes things like cultural attributes. And a lot of it is walked into their assessment of government. If they don't feel government serves their interests, or government in general is a vehicle for their advancement, they may feel they're voting their interest to vote for the Republicans because they feel like, on balance, their government doesn't do much for them, so it's a waste of their money. And in fact, I think the weight of the evidence suggests that the decline in support among the white working class for Democrats over the last 40 years or so really has a lot to do with that. It's actually not driven that much by cultural issues, or less so by cultural issues, more by that view that the government isn't really producing that much for me, and it's taking money out of my pocket and putting it into someone else's pocket. So that's a hard thing to turn around, though I think there's some evidence that if you look at younger white working class voters, they're considerably less anti-government than older generations among the white working class, and much more open to the kind of political economic policies represented by the Democrats. Now, that all said, probably the single thing, given where white working class voters are coming from today, given how conservatively they do vote, the single thing that's the best for progressives about that group is just there's less of them every year.
Where are they going?
Well, there's less white people every year, and there's less people who don't have a four-year college degree and or a sort of more exalted job. I mean, there's lots of different ways to define the white working class, but all of them tend to show roughly the same level of decline. So you put those two factors together, and we're talking about a half a percentage point decline in their share of the population and share of voters every year. So, you just keep chipping away at that margin. Look, back in, the early 1940s, probably 86% of the population could have been classified as white working class. We're far, far away from that today. We're under 50%, according to all data, including the census data. The exit polls tend to have it a little lower, but they're definitely a declining force, and they're a declining force in every state. I mean, you look at state after state after state, and there's some detail in this in my report, and you see basically declines of from a half to three-quarters of a percentage point a year. So you look over a 20-year period, and that's 10 to 15 points decline in the share of voters who are white working class, who are conservative, and then their place is being taken by minority voters primarily, and then secondarily by college-educated white voters who are actually tending to shift left over time. So this is a huge, distributional shift in overall in the country and in particular states, and it's having a big effect on the politics of pretty much every state.
I'm speaking with Reed Teixeira, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation and Center for American Progress and author of a paper, Demographic Change and the Future of the Parties, which you can get from the Center for American Progress website, which I believe is what, AmericanProgress.org, right?
Correct.
So a couple of other demographic changes. I want to talk about what it all means afterwards. The young folks moving increasingly at, well, I don't know what they're saying, to the left, but certainly into the Democratic column.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this just a youth effect, or how is this different from previous generations of young folks?
No, this isn't a youth effect. There may be some youth effect, but the fact of the matter is that generations, as they come into the electorate, tend to adopt the characteristics that reflect the era in which they grew up. In other words, it's not always true that young people are particularly liberal and older people are much more conservative. Sometimes it can be reversed. Now, in this case, we've got young people coming in. They are much more liberal than older generations, and the data suggests that, in fact, they will mostly stay that way, that the attitudes that make people progressive or liberal in their 20s, and that they vote on that basis in their 20s, most of it tends to stick with them as they get older. The life cycle effects are much less powerful than people believe, and in fact, most of the stuff that matters is actually pretty sticky. So if this generation is liberal now, it's more likely, much more likely than not, to stay pretty liberal over time. I mean, the asterisk there is, well, some of it depends, obviously, on how well the Obama administration and America in general is perceived as performing in the next few years. That can have a dampening effect on this lean, because it's sort of like, they're inclined to give Democrats the benefit of the doubt. They're pretty hostile to the Republicans and to the conservatives. But the end of the day, you've got to produce. So, you know, that could be a factor weighting the scales back in the other direction. But at least based on their views on government, based on their views on social issues, based on their views on foreign policy issues, based on their general images of the two parties, I mean, this is the generation that just has a very clear and distinct lean toward the Democrats. And pretty much everybody agrees that this is true. This isn't just my analysis. Pew Research Center has put out a number of polls. I mean, everybody pretty much acknowledges, even Republicans, if you beat on them a little bit, will acknowledge this is a bit of a problem for them.
Yeah, I saw a study a while back, and I can't remember who did it, but it showed that this generation, whether they the late teens and their 20s now, are the most progressive generation in the history of public opinion research.
I think that's true. It's, you know, not that public opinion research goes back that far, but yeah, I mean, where we got data, this is the most progressive generation. For example, substantially more progressive than the generation that came of age in the 60s. I mean, the other, the most progressive generation in the electorate besides millennials tend to be the early boomers, people born from roughly 46 to 53 or 54.
Hey, that's my people.
Yeah, right, me too. So, but, you know, we're out progressive by this new generation.
Well, I'm happy to cede it to them. And I just want to underscore the point, which I was struck by in reading your report, that people do not necessarily get conservative as they get older, and that they tend to stick with the political philosophy that they come of age with.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you and I are no different than most people. You know, you tend to stay. Your views may evolve a little bit over the years, but your basic stance, what you believe in, the kinds of things you favor, the things you like, the things you don't like, and, you know, related to that, your attitude toward the two parties that we have, for better or worse, it tends to remain pretty stable.
And now, just finally, the demographic thing. We used to speak of the professional managerial class kind of as a single thing, but professionals and managers are moving in different directions, it seems. Professionals are liberal, Democrat, progressive, whatever you want to call them, and managers are leaning more in the conservative Republican direction. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. It's not as well known as it should be for a change in American politics. It's so sharp. It's one of the great stylized facts about the evolution of American politics in the last several decades, is how thoroughly professionals have realigned toward the Democratic Party as they've increased their numbers as well. At one point, they were the most conservative occupational group back in the late 50s and early 60s, but that's totally flipped since then, really took off in the 80s. And now, my estimate is that, you know, the NES hasn't released their data, National Election Study for 2008, but, you know, I would think that professional support for Obama in 2008 probably pushed 70%. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
And now, putting all this together, you also show that upper middle class voters, people, the households in $100,000 plus income class, are also leaning pretty heavily Democratic. So you put all this together, professionals, upper income people, people in the newer suburbs. We didn't get the chance.
I didn't really say, just to correct you a little bit, Doug, I didn't say the upper middle class is heavily Democratic so much as they're sort of being pushed in a more Democratic direction by the weight of professionals in that group. But they're still contested. It's just they used to be, you know, a gimme for the Republicans. So the Republican differential among this group is being compressed and in some cases just completely eliminated, which is a big loss for them because it used to be, well, you want to know how Republican someone's going to be. Look at their income level. It's no longer as easy to say.
Now, we put all this together, though. We see, I think, this might mean, as you argue, that the Republicans will have to become less conservative because they're going to lose their really hardcore popular base as the white working class evangelical voter shrinks as a portion of the electorate. But on the other hand, won't this encourage a kind of centrist, socially tolerant, but not exactly redistributionist policy tendency among the Democratic Party in the years ahead?
I think that's not unreasonable. I mean, to the extent there was any chance of returning to what we think of as New Deal liberalism in the future, I mean, these kinds of changes don't necessarily help that. I mean, I think they help the center-left in general, but what exactly the politics of the center-left will be is heavily influenced by these changes, and not all of them certainly would lead one in the direction of a full-throated liberalism. It's a bit more modest or moderate a stance. Still at all, I mean, and I would say broadly progressive is a fair way of characterizing it. It's just, you know, big government programs, high levels of taxation. I mean, these are things that will have to be handled gingerly. And, you know, to some extent, that's always been the case in American politics. But, you know, that's certainly that's something that will have to require careful attention in the future. But, you know, that's why they pay the politicians the big bucks, I guess. They have to figure out how to thread the needle.
And finally, just these changes probably will force the Republicans over the time to become less troglodytic.
I think so. I mean, I think parties take a while to learn. Look at how long it took the Democrats, after getting beaten over the head in the 70s and 80s, to finally figure out they had to change some of the way they did things. Parties are rational, maybe in a long-range sense, but in a short-run sense, they're not that rational. They tend to stick with what got them there. They have all kinds of factional, internal, and structural problems that prevent them from changing very fast. It's like turning a battleship. And they need to get whacked pretty hard at least several times before they finally realize there is no escape. We do have to do things differently than we've been doing them. And the Republicans clearly aren't there yet. They've doubled down on the most, you know, intransigent aspects of their philosophy since Obama got elected, but a lot of that's traceable to the fact they can make big political hay out of the economic crisis and blame everything on Obama why things aren't getting better. But, you know, that's only going to last for so long, and then I think they'll be back in the soup, and if they're plopped right in the soup again like they get their clock cleaned in 2012, that's when I think you might see a little bit more of a rethink by Republicans. But whether it happens then or a bit later, I don't think you can escape from this sort of demographic political pressure. You're eventually going to have to compete for the groups that the Democrats are now dominating.
All right. Thank you. I've been speaking with Reed Teixeira, who is a fellow at the Center for American Progress and also the Century Foundation. And you can get his report, Demographic Change and the Future of the Parties, at the Center for American Progress website, which is americanprogress.org. This is WBAI, 99.5 in your FM dial in New York, and also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, hit that donate button. We can always use the help. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about guns. And that was some of Vegetable Karma by the composer Alice Shields. I didn't realize vegetables have karma, but I guess they do. And that is from her Three Electronic Works. And she is now the second composer who's contacted me. She contacted me on Facebook the other day. She listened to the show and said hello. And I looked up some of her music. The composer Julie Harting did that a couple of years ago. The daughter of the composer Vivian Fine also listened to the show and contacted me and introduced me to her mother's work, which I'll be playing sometime soon. So nice to hear some composers out there listening. We are now joined by William Hartung, who is a fellow at the Center for America, not the Center for America, the New America Foundation. All these names kind of blend together, the fund for the Center of Progress and all. Welcome, Bill Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me. There are a lot of American-related think tanks, there's no question about it.
And there are a lot of centers. Christopher Hitchens once wrote a masterful parody of an op-ed for Fair's magazine Extra, in which he quoted the Center for the Study of the Center.
I fear that I might be working at that
point. Well, anyway, let's talk about defense policy. First of all, I think a lot of people who voted for Obama are a little taken aback by how much he's continued the Bush foreign policy. How much continuity is there in the national security strategy?
Well, I think, you know, quite a bit. There's some of the language is more nuanced. Certainly there's not the kind of upfront, you know, endorsement of preventive wars. But it does say that if needed, the United States will strike first. And likewise, it does not really say when we wouldn't use force. I mean, there's kind of this whole series of possibilities from humanitarian disasters to, you know, helping regional allies. It's pretty much the whole menu that was on the table under Bush, with the difference that they say, well, ideally it'll be a last resort and we'd like to use a mix of civilian and military tools. And so I would say maybe some of the tactics are different, but the I don't think the goals have changed dramatically.
And the war in Afghanistan, I think I read recently that's about to surpass Iraq as an expense?
Yes, that's right. You know, it happened this year, and then next year's budget is going to be quite dramatic, about $110 billion for Afghanistan and about $40 billion for Iraq. And likewise with the troops levels, there are now more U.S. troops in Afghanistan than in Iraq. So it's really beginning to be the driver of the kind of military supplementals that they put in every year in the budget.
And do you have any sense of what the strategy is in Iraq, in Afghanistan, rather? What would victory look like?
Well, I don't know if the administration even knows what it's aiming for anymore. You know, my own feeling is victory would be to get out and perhaps have some sort of political cover so that it's not doesn't play in the broad American public and in Republican circles is a, you know, massive defeat for U.S. power. But in terms of what the administration is looking for, you know, I think, you know, the way they talk about it, they want good governance, they want an end to corruption, they want to defeat or at least limit the reach of the Taliban, things which are not happening. I mean, the Inspector General for Afghanistan did a report saying that there's not a single unit of the Afghan military that can operate on its own without support of U.S. forces, and that the main problems are corruption, drug abuse, and illiteracy. So it doesn't. That's a big kind of pillar of the Obama strategy, is that they're going to stand up this independent Afghan army that's going to go toe-to-toe with the Taliban, and that... after $27 billion spent on training, that's just not in the cards.
What, if anything, does the replacement of McChrystal by Petraeus mean?
Well, you know, they might actually hit harder. I mean, in his confirmation hearings, Petraeus said, well, we're not going to, you know, put our troops at unnecessary risk. And so McChrystal was viewed as kind of almost the dove because they were limiting certain kinds of air support and certain kinds of bombing to try to reduce civilian casualties. And the kind of conventional wisdom is that this is making it more dangerous for the troops and there's more casualties as a result. So
so there'll be more dead Afghan civilians now.
Exactly. That seems to be the implication of what Petraeus was saying in the hearings. You know, it's a little bit of move away from the good cop, bad cop counterinsurgency approach of McChrystal to maybe a slightly more military emphasis.
So what about winning the hearts and minds, as the old saying goes?
You know, I haven't seen a lot of evidence of that. You know, the administration says, well, you know, people are just afraid. They're afraid of the Taliban. They're afraid to, you know, express their support for what the U.S. is doing. McChrystal even said, well, you know, our first task is to convince people to support their own government, which I think is quite telling. And, of course, it's widely believed that Karzai stole the election or at least fixed it. And corruption has not been reduced. In fact, there's been some reporting that the Karzai administration is blocking corruption investigations of people in its close circles. So, you know, for the average person, if there is an average person in Afghanistan in the midst of all this chaos, I would be surprised if they're sitting there thinking, you know, thank God for the United States having troops here. There may be some who are sitting on the fence, kind of, you know, what's worse, the Taliban or an occupation. But I don't think there's any groundswell of support for the idea of continued U.S. presence.
I'm speaking with William Hartung, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation. Meanwhile, we had Joe Biden visiting in a flyby visit to Iraq the other day, and he was saying you'd be surprised how well things are going there, or something to that effect. What in God's name is he talking about?
Well, you know, I don't think you know that there's still religious and ethnic divides. There's still suicide bombings. There's difficulty in forming a consensus government. I think this is kind of under the category of maybe we can get out and nobody will notice because of the buildup in Afghanistan. So, you know, after all the money and all the lives that have been lost, they certainly haven't built the, new democratic, accountable government in Afghanistan that the Bush administration kept promising.
So is this kind of a foretaste of what we can expect in Afghanistan in a few years? Things are going really well, now we can get out?
I think that might be the best case. The worst case is, some of the scenarios are saying, well, we can lick this problem if we just give us another 10 years, which would be the, by far the longest intervention in the history of, U.S. involvement in conflict.
Yeah, it's already 7, right? No, another 10 would be 17. How long were you in Vietnam?
I guess it depends where you start counting.
Yeah.
If you count the covert stuff in the 50s, you might say close to 20 years. If you count from the troop buildup, it'd be more like 10 or so.
I think that's not a precedent anyone particularly wants to invoke, though.
No. And sometimes it's funny. Some of the strategists point positively to certain aspects of the Vietnam experience as being lessons for Afghanistan.
What might those be?
Things like the some of the aid programs, like the CORDS program, which were also in parallel with assassination programs like the Phoenix program. So there's sort of this argument that you could somehow separate out just sort of the economic piece of it from the fact that, there was systematic assassinations and rounding up people.
But they are doing systematic assassinations by drone, aren't they?
Yes, and more so in Pakistan. But that's, it's not even being glossed over. They're kind of bragging about it.
Well, this is one way that Obama has solved the Gitmo problem, right, by just killing people instead of capturing them?
I think that's, not that he's closing Guantanamo, but I think that's more of the, some degree, the Israeli model that that seems to be Obama's preferred modus operandi. And certainly with respect to Pakistan, he's been much more aggressive even than the Bush administration was.
So they've renamed the Global War on Terror, right? It's now got some sort of bureaucratic mouthful of a name.
Yes. Sometimes they call it Overseas Contingency
Operation. Oh, right. That's the phrase I was trying to remember, yes.
Which is, they're going for the most kind of antiseptic term they can come up with.
But what if substance is different from the GWAT?
Well, I would say certainly in Afghanistan, I don't see any great difference. I was going to say, but they're not, seeking to fight on as many fronts, but that might be hard to argue given activity in Yemen and in Somalia and I wish it were the case that they were at least narrowing the focus of where the killing was happening. But I think, given what we've learned and also what may be happening covertly, it's probably hard to make that case.
So let's talk budgets for a bit. The fiscal pressures are enormous. We're all worried about debt and deficits, and yet almost nobody is talking about how much the Pentagon is spending. So give us some idea first of the scale of Pentagon spending compared to recent years.
Well, it's interesting. The overall military budget has more than doubled since the Bush administration came in, but that includes the money for the wars as well as the kind of base Pentagon budget. But even just the Pentagon budget by itself without the wars, has gone up about 70%.
Are we still fighting wars off budget, or they brought them on budget now?
Well, they never really brought them on budget. They claim that they're giving a greater level of detail than was given under Bush. But the idea of having one budget, or even projecting the cost over more than a very short time frame, really hasn't come to be. And the thing about the Pentagon budget is there's a lot of talk about, well, we can't cut spending in times of war. But even if you said, all right, take what you want for the wars, we're not going to even argue about that. The Pentagon's base budget at about $550 billion is...
$550 is not including the cost of the two wars.
Right, right. The wars run about $150 in recent years. So there's more than three, almost four times as much for the base Pentagon budget as for Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's huge amounts of waste and, preparations for conflicts that are hopefully never going to happen, like, fighting China in 20 years and things like that.
So putting those two together, that's $700 billion. That would fund a universal child care program for 10 years, just putting that in perspective. What are they spending on besides these wars? Are there contingency plans for a war with China in 20 years?
Well, that's kind of the fallback argument, is that, they have sometimes they don't always say China, but they say, rival powers or emerging powers or, sort of code words for we have to be ready for China. But even Robert Gates, who's no peacenik, has said in a speech where he was trying to push for eliminating the F-22 combat aircraft, he said, well, even if we don't build another plane, we're going to have 20 times as many advanced combat aircraft as China 20 years from now. So there's kind of a disconnect between the notion of spending more to be ready for the Chinese threat when, our own Secretary of Defense is saying, well, I don't really see that happening. But I think in the trenches of the Pentagon, that's the best they can come up with.
And then is there anybody in Congress actually eyeing the military budget as a way to save some money?
Well, probably the most vocal person has been Barney Frank, and he's had this...
Who's good at being vocal.
Yes, very good, actually. And he has linked up with some odd bedfellows. Ron Paul has been sort of doing this tag team with him, and Walter Jones, who's a Republican from North Carolina who represents the district where Fort Bragg is based. Senator Wyden from Oregon has spoken out. And they've kind of loosely affiliated themselves with a proposal that I was involved in developing that would call for cutting about $100 billion a year from the Pentagon over 10 years, so almost a trillion in a 10-year period. And that would come entirely from the base Pentagon budget. It wouldn't even account for whether we could save money by winding down the wars. Most of the other members of Congress who are talking about, putting the Pentagon on the table in terms of deficit reduction discussions are really talking about slowing the rate of growth. Instead of 3%, maybe it'll be 1%.
What about this Deficit Reduction Commission, Bowles and Simpson lead? Anybody on that panel that's sympathetic to this approach?
Well, of all people, Tom Coburn, who's a very right-wing senator from Oklahoma, but does have a reputation of not liking pork barrel spending, and he sent a letter to the commission. Oh, he's a member, but he sent to the chairs and the other members a letter basically saying, if the Pentagon can't be audited, its books are not in good enough shape to really tell where the money's going. We shouldn't be throwing these hundreds of billions at it. They should have to prove that they're spending the money wisely.
Now, let's repeat that. The Pentagon's books are in such bad shape that it can't even be audited.
Yes, which has been the case for, several decades. So there's, the things that have come to light tend to be, they've got things in their inventory that they didn't realize were there, and they're buying new ones, or they buy stuff, and then 3 weeks later, they throw it in a warehouse somewhere because they realize they didn't actually need it. Double billing for transportation costs, not to mention corruption from contractors. So nobody knows for sure how much is siphoned off through that kind of financial irresponsibility, but it's probably a significant sum in the billions or, even tens of billions.
Finally, we're just about out of time, but you are on a panel that Barney Frank put together, right? Tell us about that and who's on it.
Yes, at Representative Frank's request, a group of us formed a task force, which I had mentioned the level of cuts that we were pushing for, but it includes Carl Canetta, who's at the Project on Defense Alternatives, Lawrence Korb at Center for American Progress, Winslow Wheeler at Center for Defense Information, Taxpayers for Common Sense, which is kind of a good government group, Institute for Policy Studies, a couple guys from the Cato Institute, and some of them have some histories on the Republican side of the aisle, although probably most of them now would be, either have been or would be excommunicated by the current Republican crowd. But anyway, there's about a dozen groups involved, and this is the first time that we've worked together to talk about what kind of cuts could be made in quite a while, because under Bush it seems so unlikely that there would be cuts that people sort of stopped throwing those ideas out in any significant way. But now with the pressure from the deficit and at least a few members of Congress showing interest, that there's been a bit of a revival of work on this subject by some of the non-governmental groups that have the knowledge but haven't really put on much of a push in recent years.
All right, thanks. I've been speaking with Bill Hartung, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation and has a piece in The Nation magazine, June 28 issue, What Price for Defense? That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. And let's go out with this, a bit of Bad Religion's Let Them Eat War. Till next week. Bye.